one of the pleasures of both performing in D.C. at the Kennedy Center and being on Twitter is that I have got to meet, work with, and follow, and be followed in return by Scott Simon from National Public Radio, whose voice you probably recognize. He is a broadcaster. He hosts the Weekend Edition with Scott Simon every Saturday morning. He's a journalist. He's a novelist. He is...
Adult films, too.
He does adult films.
Who are we kidding? A lot of the people downloading this will know what I'm talking about.
They'll know exactly who you are. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 243, Meet Scott Simon. On our final weekend at the Kennedy Center, I finally got to sit down for a casual conversation with Scott Simon from National Public Radio, of whom I have been a fan for decades and am now happy to call a friend. Over post-show beverages in the surprisingly loud piano bar lounge of Rivers at the Watergate just across the street from the Kennedy Center, Scott told me that in addition to all his other talents as a journalist, broadcaster, novelist, and inveterate tweeter, he is about to become a playwright.
The working title is Hey Chicago, Who's Your Favorite Clown? And the beauty of it, of course, is that if it opens in Louisville, it can be Hey Louisville, Who's Your Favorite Clown?
Lovely. And
the whole premise is about somebody who plays, forgive me, a local television clown. I know, you can fill in the blank as to who that would be.
Yes.
And yet, as they'll say, because people will say, hey, you're the character of the clown's name, which is still under some discussion, so
right.
I won't name it. And he'll say, I'm not a clown, I'm an actor who plays a clown. Because he's at that point in his career when he's just a little bit sensitive about that.
Right.
You know,
right.
This is somebody who began as an actor 20 years ago, and he wanted to play Lear, and he wanted to play, all that sort of thing. And now he's a local television clown.
Right.
And he's just a little sensitive about the fact that he's not the clown.
The clown. Is this your first play? Is this one of many?
It would be my first play, yeah. Well,
wow.
I mean, no, wait. To be technically accurate, I wrote many plays in, the first grade, the third grade, all that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, so I like to think that I've paid my dues in the theater.
Well,
it's not that, yeah. And, yes, it would be. Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Well,
the next novel I'm working on, actually, I've become a bit of a lyricist in that because there's always been that man. Well,
a poet as well.
Lyricist, or not a good one.
Okay.
I won't fail. Next novel I'm working on is set in Germany during World War II. And as almost everybody knows, of course, the Nazis banned jazz and swing music.
Yes.
They called it degenerate art.
Yeah. They banned quite a few things, if memory serves.
Yeah. I don't mean to say that was they were good guys.
No, you're
except
right.
Except for the fact that they banned jazz and swing music.
Bastards.
Yeah, that's right. How could they do that? And they, however, Dr. Goebbels kept a jazz and swing orchestra employed that played on nightly propaganda broadcasts, and they would take the biggest jazz and swing hits, and they would write these utterly hideous anti-Semitic and racist lyrics to them, and they would play them with the big band and the jazz beat, and they would and they would play them on the nightly propaganda broadcasts. So there are a few recordings that exist of that, but not enough to fill the book.
Yeah.
So I'm able to write hideously anti-Semitic and racist lyrics in that novel. So,
a dream fulfilled. Really.
I'm the Sondheim of the white Aryan nation. I like to think of myself. Yeah.
That will look so good on the book on the cover.
I think absolutely right. Yeah. If Stephen Sondheim would say, "If I were a Nazi, this is the book I'd write."
The book I would write. Well, it's probably only fair that we with this podcast we venture ever so slightly and tinily into your arena as a broadcaster. Now you're venturing into our arena as a playwright.
Yeah. Sorry.
Among all those things that you do, one of the qualities that I love so much about listening just to Weekend Edition every Saturday is not only are you all of these things, but like a true son of Chicago, you are an improviser. You are so good with all of your guests. I mean, you go from the serious news of the day, interviewing, victims of tragedy and whatever, to you know, ridiculous idiots like the Renew Shakespeare Company.
Most prominently, the
present company, or Daniel Pinkwater, or the horrible music guy that you bring on.
Annoying music.
Forgive me. Your ability to mirror, as they say in improv, is that something you learn as a broadcaster, or is that something you Chicagoans are born with?
I think Chicagoans might have a little bit more experience.
Yeah.
I get around the country a lot, so I don't say this without having thought it through a little bit. I think there is something about Chicago that exposes you to a lot of different kinds of people and a lot of different kinds of situations.
Yeah.
And you see, when all is said and done, they're all part of the same human fabric, and that it's really not a stretch to go between someone who's a victim of a tragedy to someone who is part of a tragedy to someone who was trying to make you laugh, that it's all part of the same human story. And although you talk to them a little bit differently, it's all part of the same human story, and it's all part of what we're interested in. And I do think, with all due regard to people who live elsewhere, that Chicago just has a little bit more concentrated experience than
it
some
does.
Other places.
It is incredibly diverse in a very small area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of it. I mean, I think, for example, one of the reasons why improv comedy took off in Chicago was you had that kind of concentrated experience, but yet at the same time, it wasn't New York.
Yeah.
People weren't always kind of cutting off the top branches and saying, you know, make this cough drop ad.
Right.
There was a kind of theater culture, and for that matter, entertainment culture that could exist.
And ensemble culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, everybody works together. I mean, there is just something. I mean, there's a difference between, I mean, I imagine there is, between being a journalist and a broadcaster. Are they? Can you define what those differences are?
Well, not every journalist is a broadcaster, and vice versa. I mean, I hope I'm a journalist, a reasonably good one. But at the same time, a broadcaster has to do is make people want to hear the story. I don't mean to be treated like rocket science, but there's an alchemy. I mean, just as in the theater, there's this property that I've heard called elf skit. There are just some people who make you want to watch them.
Right.
And I think that's also true of broadcasting. There are just some people that you want to listen to.
Yeah.
Now, gosh knows,
it's not necessarily the deepest voice.
because that can just pass through people after a while.
Right.
I don't know. I think there's a quality of engagement that communicates itself.
Yeah.
Well, Dan Shore, and you and I are speaking on the year anniversary of Dan Shore's death, interestingly.
Are we really? Of course.
Yeah, as a matter of fact. And Dan Shore loved to tell the story about Edward R. Murrow saying to him, the key to this business, kid, is sincerity. If you can fake that, you've got it made. You've heard that story, right? You may have heard it with
attributed
names.
Other people. Yeah.
I think there's something to that. I mean, if you communicate something that both, I think, suggests something that you're interested, but also that you're really interested.
Yeah.
You're not just going through the motions. I think that counts for something.
Well, that makes sense. And the reason I ask is that you've been on National Public Radio for how long now?
It's a long time. 25
years. You've just been a voice in my head for many years, and I knew of your reporting from Bosnia, and I went, oh yeah, that's the guy who was in Bosnia, and I knew of you hosting, you know, Morning Weekend Edition. But suddenly something clicked for me, as I suspect it did for many Americans, on 9/11. And you anchored so much of NPR's live coverage of the events of 9/11. And I was in shock, as everybody else was, but also sort of dazzled by the high wire act of what you were doing. I mean, we just spent a funny evening together, and we're having a funny evening, and now we're talking about this.
9/11, yeah.
But 9/11. But that high wire act of you keep juggling, literally juggling all the various stories, and I suspect you had a lot of people talking in your head while you're talking to people, and you're keeping the story straight, and you're trying to be responsible and not say the wrong thing, and et cetera. I mean, what was that like to do that?
You know, it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds peculiar given the great overwhelming international tragedy it was. But as my wife and I agreed at that point, if I were a shoe salesman, I don't know what I would have done. In a peculiar way, I felt we had a job to do that could help people.
Yeah.
And I know how hurt we were. I know how literally emotionally wounded we were.
Yeah.
And we found it absolutely therapeutic and desirable to be able to do something that could give something to other people at that time for the country.
Yeah.
And I think I don't want to say I didn't find it difficult, because of course I did find it difficult, but at the same time we had these very vivid images of people who were really doing the difficult work down by Ground Zero. And so it would be churlish to complain that we had anything resembling a real chore at that particular point, so much as we wanted to be a part of something that might be able to help people. And we found it very rewarding. And, you know, and we knew that there were people that were turning to us. And this is another difference between broadcaster and journalist. A journalist will say, understandably, that's as much of the story as I have at the moment. I don't want to go on too much because it would be irresponsible for me to speculate.
Right.
Now, I don't think broadcasters should speculate irresponsibly, but at the same time, we understand that sometimes you have to be on the air for 12 hours because people want to hear you.
Right.
Because people want to hear the story sometimes over and over again.
Right.
And
well,
and
they're
that's
tuning
part of what we do, too.
Yeah, and they're tuning in late, and they're having to... Your voice, your coverage, is a balm, a soothing influence on all of us.
Yeah, and I'm perfectly fine with that. I think that's part of what we should be able to do when we're in our business.
Yeah.
And you know, welcome the opportunity.
Well, and that's what they say, when the chips are down, when tragedy strikes, everybody's true colors come out. And this was the thing you were born to do, clearly, because you just, you know, steered that.
I was very glad that we could do it. And my wife and I, at that point, were going back and forth between New York and Washington. And we spent a lot of time around Canal Street down Zero, because our apartment then in New York was in Mott Street in Chinatown, which is not that many blocks that we, you know, actually north of it. And we used to stand along Canal Street and cheer the trucks that were going in and out, and the emergency workers and the relief workers. And, you know, we should do that more often, you know. I think we understood that they were doing immensely important things for everybody at that particular point. And I'm glad we did that. And my wife and I have often, our children are now 8 and 4. I think our 8-year-old will obviously be exposed to a lot of the 9/11 10-year anniversary coverage. You know, and I think we want them to grow up hearing from us what those days were like and what they meant in our lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, hope that something of that feeling passes to them.
You're listening to Tim Minchin, randomly standing here with Austin and et al. In Washington, D.C., and you are listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall, we'll be touring the complete world of sports abridged in September and October, with performances in Gainesville, Florida, Athens, Georgia, Decatur, Alabama, and New York City at the New Victory Theater. We'll also be giving 2 performances of All the Great Books abridged at Pepperdine University in Malibu and Caltech in Pasadena, California. And we'll be premiering our 8th stage production of The Ultimate Christmas Show abridged at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe, and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Scott Simon. So you're a novelist. You wrote a really toe-tapping book about Bosnia.
Yeah. It's called Pretty Birds, and I'd like to see it made into a musical. Actually, I would love to see it made into a musical. I thought, what an artistic challenge that would be.
Well, it is well regarded, but it's hardly toe-tapping. Yeah. But then you have another novel called Windy City, and as I am moving back to Chicago, that became my excuse to read it, and I'm halfway through it, and I'm loving your lead character. Sonny Rupini, an Indian American alderman. It's about the alderman structure of Chicago politics. But you have a thing in the early on the early pages about politicians, aldermen specifically. They get in trouble for telling off-color jokes, whatever. But they keep the tanks off the streets. Trash gets picked up. Snow gets plowed. The trains make all the stops. You live and work here in Washington, D.C., and this tells me that you love politicians.
You know,
is that true?
I do, and I, you know, it's interestingly. I mean, not all of them,
right?
But I think that there's a fundamental importance to what they do that I've grown to respect. You know, and when I began writing Windy City, it was a much more cynical kind of book. But my family and I were subletting a place in Chicago, and I talked to a lot of aldermen, interestingly, who were, I mean, they knew me as a newsman, but when they found out that this was a novel and there wouldn't be exact quotation, boy, did they lay unfolded like flowers under the sun, like somebody had been waiting to ask them these questions. You know, and I wound up concluding, seeing them long-term, close-up, that there really is a kind of fundamental integrity in the job.
Yeah.
That even the lowliest of them, and there may be no form of human life that's lower than a Chicago alderman, that you have to respect.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, when it snows, their cell phones ring in their pockets,
yeah,
and they're expected to do something about it, like what can you do about the snow. They're always on call. They're relentlessly exposed. They don't have the retinue of people protecting them from public scrutiny that mayors, presidents do.
Right.
And it's a tough way to live. And I think somebody who willingly puts themselves in that position,
yeah,
to fracture their family life, to make... Look, I mean, I think at one point one of my characters says in the book, if you go to the Lakeview Citizens Council meeting on Thursday, you have to go to the Edgewater Citizens Council meeting on Friday, or else they'll say, why do you prefer Lakeview to Edgewater?
Right.
And it's just an absolutely relentless drain on your time, on your emotional and physical energy. And then, you know, you're supposed to care about that above everything else in the world, and then at some point you turn around and say, oh, I have a family.
Yeah.
They're the people who really can keep me connected to this earth and actually give me perspective anyway. And I think people who willingly do that,
yeah,
even if occasionally a little coin falls off the table and they put it in their pocket,
right,
I think it fundamentally there's something about that I respect.
Well, and that, I think it shows your empathy, that, you know, you are refreshingly free of cynicism, and I would imagine you have to be that way as a broadcaster, but it seems like being a novelist is different than being a journalist.
Oh, sure,
yeah.
Which is why I like it.
Yeah.
Which is also why I don't think I would be a journalist as long as I've been a journalist if I didn't have the outlet for expression that novels provides.
Okay, right.
And it's not like I'm expressing schizophrenic parts of me, but, you know, I'm able to do things in a novel that you can't and really shouldn't do as a journalist.
Right.
And I think that's fine. I think it keeps me fresh for my journalism at the same time.
But also, as a journalist, don't you have to be a little cynical? Don't you have to assume the guy's lying?
Sure, absolutely, yeah, you should.
But as a novelist, you want to be empathetic to the guy who might pick up a coin that fell off the table and,
yeah,
put it into his pocket.
Yeah, and I think that's important not to lose that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we would want it from other people at the same time.
Right. Interesting. Well, I want to thank you for doing this.
And first interview I've ever done with a glass of wine in my hand.
I was going to say, going against your self-imposed prohibition against being interviewed while drinking wine.
But it's just white wine.
Of course it's white wine. You're from National Public Radio.
Sorry about that.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your piano bar requests via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, Peabody ignored journalist Matthew Croak. Music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Declan McGuire. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Aussie singer, songwriter, comedian, and composer Tim Minchin, who just completed a tour of the United States and who wrote the score for the West End musical Matilda, which opens in London in October, and who was introduced to us by Scott Simon. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 243/729 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Since you have been drinking, did you want to go on the record as saying something in front of a live microphone about the Complete World of Sports Abridged that you saw tonight?
It was great. I loved the show. It was wonderful.
Right. Let me take another sip of wine and gather up my courage.
No, I loved the show. It was absolutely great. It's smart. It's funny. Even unexpectedly insightful and moving in a couple of instances. More than a couple of instances. You know, and I'm a sports fan. I'm very much a sports fan. And I thought this just had absolutely the right note of irreverence. And yet, you know, at some point, it's clearly the product of people who know sports and who think at the end of the day there is something there that's worth, you know, that worth the interest of people to pay attention to. And I, you know, I thought it was great. It's just a wonderful show.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.